Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? I hope you've all had a great week. Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. This week I have an interview with Michael Sonnenschein from Grayscale Capital. And with prices under pressure pretty much since January, a lot of people keep asking the question, where are the institutional investors? What are they investing in? What are they doing? Where are they? We need them. Quite an interesting question, always pops up on Twitter. So with Michael in London, I thought it would be a good chance to have a chat with him. He was in town for the Blockchain Alternative Investment Conference. So I reached out to him. I said, can we have a chat? He said yes, which was pretty cool of him. So we met at the conference. We did it in the press room, so there's a little bit of background noise, but it's all okay. If you don't know Grayscale, they're part of Barry Silbert's Digital Currency Group, and they provide a number of products for institutional investors. They come in the form of a single asset trust, but they also have a diversified fund. So the single asset trust are for the main currencies that you know of, your Bitcoins, your Ethereums, your Litecoins. And actually, they've also recently started a trust for Zencash, which was quite an interesting trust. That's something we spoke about during the podcast. But they do also have the diversified fund for those people who want an exposure to a mixed portfolio of assets. So very, very cool. Michael is the managing director of Grayscale, but he also has a track record on both sides of the space, which makes him a really interesting person to chat to. His banking career started with Barclays. He's also been at JP Morgan before he went to Grayscale and worked his way through the ranks. So yeah, he's got a broad experience across the market. He understands from both sides of investment, from the traditional banking side and from this new crypto side. So yeah, makes a great person to chat to. In other news, I've joined the Let's Talk Bitcoin network of podcasts, which is really cool. A number of other really great podcasts on that network. If you don't know it, it's worth checking out. But yeah, big thanks to those guys for inviting me to join them. Hopefully it'll get a bit more exposure to the podcast, which is always very cool. Also, please do continue to support the show. Everyone who's left me a review, honestly, it means so much to me. And if you haven't and you don't mind, please head over to iTunes and leave me a review if you think it deserves 5 stars. That's really cool because these reviews, they help with the podcast getting increased exposure on iTunes when people are looking up crypto or looking up Bitcoin. So thank you if you have done that. And if you haven't, please do. Please follow me on social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Steemit. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on everything. And my handle on everything is at What Bitcoin Did. You can find me there. You can ask me any questions. I will try and reply back to you. I pretty much reply to everyone. You can check out my website. That's www.whatbitcoindid.com. And you can share this podcast out with any of your friends and family who you think might be interested. Okay, moving on to the interview with Michael. I do hope you enjoy this. It was really, really cool to get him on the show. It was cool to understand a bit more about how the institutions work, how they think, and the products that Grayscale are building for them. So yeah, if you've got any questions, please feel free to give me a shout. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I will put a load in the show notes about this. I will put a list to all their products. So if you want to find out a bit more, want to understand a bit more, then that'll be up on my website for you. Okay, hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Michael. Welcome to London. You're here for the Blockchain Alternative Investment Conference. So what are you here for and who are you speaking to?
Thank you for having me. In London for just a couple of days. Certainly was here to participate in and speak at the Blockchain Alternative Investment Conference. But I think our point of view, and as I travel and speak at these types of events, it's always on providing context for institutional involvement in the space.
And that's an area everyone's interested in right now, because as we've had a price crash, people think the institutional investors are going to save us.
Everyone does seem to think that. And I think we have to bifurcate the institutional universe. I think some people think of institutions as solely being endowments and pensions and sovereign wealth funds. But that also includes family offices and hedge funds and all other types of entity investors. I think my team at Grayscale Investments in New York, we're experiencing institutional adoption of our products pretty materially. Year to date, we have raised now over $225 million in new assets this year. And almost all of that is coming from institutional investors, primarily hedge funds.
Okay, wow. And just for context, so for those who don't know, can you explain who Grayscale are and what your background is? I noticed on your LinkedIn, you've kind of gone up through the ranks at Grayscale. You're now managing director, but also, you have a background in banking. So if you can give people some context, give them your background.
Sure. So I'm a banker by trade, by background. So after my undergrad, spent time at Bank of America and then got into wealth management at Barclays as well as at JP Morgan, primarily covering middle market hedge funds and family offices, and really was running the gamut from equities to sovereign CDS and everything in between. And when I was getting my master's degree, I was ready for a new challenge, wanted to do something different, thought I would actually go work for a hedge fund and had a good offer to go work for a hedge fund, and then had the fortunate opportunity to meet our founder and CEO, Barry Silbert. Barry at the time was running a company called Second Market. Second Market, for those of you who don't know, is a platform that was providing liquidity to assets like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn before these companies went public. However, Barry had personally gotten very excited about digital currency starting in 2012. He and Tim Draper were probably two of the very first angel investors to start putting money to work in the space. And Barry had such an interest in digital currency, in Bitcoin specifically, that he convinced the Second Market board to allocate some of the company's resources into the digital currency arena. And so that laid the groundwork for what eventually became Grayscale, starting our asset management business. But if you fast forward to the end of 2015, we sold Second Market because there was so much brand confusion going on. Second Market was servicing private companies. And on the other side of the Second Market house, we had started trading digital currencies and had started incubating our asset management business. And so Second Market was purchased by NASDAQ. And post the Second Market sale, we started a new firm called Digital Currency Group. And so Digital Currency Group is a holding company. It's a C Corp and it sits on top of all the activities that we do today. When we brought Digital Currency Group together, it was really the combination of those businesses that were started under the Second Market umbrella, as well as Barry's personal angel portfolio. And so that includes investments in the seed rounds of companies like Coinbase and Ripple and BitPay and Zappo and, you know, some of the best companies that are building really the infrastructure for the space. And so when DCG formed, we did a small capital raise. And so we're fortunate to call investors like OMERS, Western Union, MasterCard, the New York Life Insurance Company, Transamerica, a couple of, more traditional VCs like Bain and RRE and Firstmark. But the idea was to do a capital raise primarily from really strategic and corporate investors. And so if you look at DCG today, it basically has three parts that make up the DCG umbrella. Number one is venture capital. So DCG is far and away the most active, the most prolific VC in our industry. It's invested now in 130 Bitcoin and blockchain related businesses in 30 countries around the world.
I've seen them on the DCG website.
Yeah, you can always keep track of them at dcg.co. Second is our balance sheet. So the balance sheet at DCG has a heavy allocation towards digital currencies in addition to cash and everything else you'd find on a balance sheet. And so there are several conviction currencies for DCG, which include Bitcoin, Ethereum Classic, Zcash, and then two newer currencies. One is called Mana. It's the currency from the Decentraland project. And another one is called Zencash, which is a privacy-focused coin. And then the third bucket of assets are the subsidiaries. So Digital Currency Group is parent to three subsidiary businesses. The first is a company called CoinDesk, which we acquired. CoinDesk is a news research and events platform. Great group of journalists at CoinDesk.com who are always writing about the space. The second subsidiary is Genesis, which is our SEC and FINRA registered broker dealer. And then the third business, which is the business that I run for us, which is called Grayscale Investments. And so Grayscale is an asset manager that is purely focused on digital currency. The models that we look at are things like iShares and WisdomTree, where we'd like to build a whole family of products that facilitate access to digital currencies. And so today, the Grayscale family has eight products under its umbrella. Seven of those products are single asset vehicles. So we have a product for Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Ethereum Classic, Litecoin, XRP, and Zcash. And then the eighth product we have is our first diversified offering, which is called the Digital Large Cap Fund.
Okay, wow, great. So there's a lot going on. So that first question it brings to mind for me is, Volatility of price, how does that affect the businesses? Is it damaging?
I wouldn't say it's damaging. I mean, if we look at the end of 2017, I mean, the Genesis trading desk had such a tremendous November and December last year. I mean, were breaking through volumes that they were trading on an OTC basis every single day. The Grayscale business would be hard to measure at that time last year because one of our vehicles, our main vehicle, the Bitcoin vehicle, was not open for subscriptions at the time. We'd reopened in December last year. So, but that really hasn't stopped us. I mean, again, the first part of this year, which, you know, we're now in mid-June, raising over $225 million so far this year. You know, I think investors are very eager to allocate to the space, and they see the convenience and cost effectiveness of expressing a view on digital currency through one of the Grayscale products.
That $225 million, how much does that, what is the total, because that's this year, but what is the total you now have under management?
So we now have about $1.5 billion. So it makes Grayscale the largest digital currency asset manager globally.
Equally, would that have been $3 billion at the end of January?
Over $3
billion. Okay. So I guess the impact on your team is the fact that you calculate your, it's between like 2 to 3% commission, right?
Yep. So we
That's daily.
We take our fees on all of the products by accruing them in the underlying coins.
So I guess for you guys, the fee has changed quite significantly from January to now.
It has. But, you know, I think we're still as excited as ever. And I think a lot of what's driving our momentum and our sentiment is seeing that institutional interest and how much money we've raised so far this year.
And so you're not seeing with the institutions any reluctance to invest because of what's happened over the last few months?
If anything, the opposite. I think a lot of investors are looking at this very opportunistically, being able to average down or leg into their trade over a series of time.
And how do you interpret the current price levels?
You know, we'll be the first to say that Bitcoin, all these assets, will likely have a binary outcome, which is why people should not be investing more in this asset class than they can afford to risk. You know, either it becomes all these wonderful, amazing things that we think it can be, or it won't. The reason why we are so of the belief that we think it will is because there's so many amazing use cases and so many that we haven't even, you know, discovered yet. All that being said, because digital assets like Bitcoin are open source protocols, as other things present themselves as a challenge to Bitcoin or any of the other open source projects, you know, we think that they stand to be able to not only incorporate some of those new elements that are challenging them, but actually foster even more innovation because they're able to adapt and morph over time.
And you mentioned the excellent use cases. What are the use cases that you've seen that that excite you?
Sure. So I think for Bitcoin specifically, I mean, it's definitely resonating with investors as a digital gold, a digital store of value. For us, looking at Bitcoin as a digital gold is really because it exhibits and has all the same attributes as gold does, whereas Bitcoin is superior to gold because it's actually finite, right? We kind of think gold is a finite asset, but, you know, somehow we keep unearthing more of it every day. And in addition to that, I think that Bitcoin is superior to gold in that it's, you know, far more divisible, far more portable, and it has a lot more utility. And we're seeing that across merchant adoption and awareness and acceptance. And as we look at global remittances and payments, you know, that's another area where actual utility of Bitcoin exceeds that of gold, which, other than maybe having some cultural value and looking pretty, doesn't really have much in the way of industrial applications.
Okay, so I understand that argument there, but you also have investment trusts for Bitcoin Cash, mm-hmm. Litecoin, Zcash. So you have a number of different forms of digital currency. Is this a hedge?
No, so I think, you know, for us, looking at the incumbent asset management industry, for us, it's always looking at what are the best players in the industry doing? If we look at a business like WisdomTree, for example, which has a whole family of products for investing in the emerging markets, they have products for China, for Russia, for India, for Japan, et cetera. And it's because they want to make sure that when investors think of digital, think of emerging markets, they think of WisdomTree, and that there's certainly a product on that menu for them to use. And I think similarly, you know, for the Grayscale team, we certainly have products and coins around which we have higher conviction, but our platform, the Grayscale family as a whole, would be missing elements if it didn't offer people the ability to express a view on those other assets like Litecoin and XRP and some of the other coins that we think are important to have on our lineup.
Therefore, I think Zencash is an interesting one because if you looked at your current investment trust that you offer, you tend to offer top 10, 15 assets, and Zencash doesn't sit within that suite. Why does Zencash interest you guys, and why did you offer it?
Sure. So we've long been believers in the idea of financial privacy. We think that in the wake of Facebook and Equifax and all these other hacks, that there is a growing need for privacy, and in particular financial privacy, almost so to the point where individuals and institutions don't even know that as time goes on, they're actually going to be paying a premium for financial privacy. And so we've long been believers in Zcash, and we're very close with the founder, Zuko, and the Zcash team, Digital Currency Group, as an investor. We think that Zcash is a phenomenal protocol, particularly around a digital store of value that has a privacy focus, or a digital payment with a privacy focus. More recently, though, we've gotten turned on to Zencash as well, not to necessarily diversify away from Zcash, but because it can actually complement it. So whereas Zcash is primarily used for digital, you know, store of value or payments, the Zencash protocol exhibits many of the same qualities, but actually has applications around private messaging, private file storage, private internet access, et cetera. And so we're excited not only by the team, but by the protocol itself, and often do sometimes go against that of other investors in choosing these assets that may not be in the top five or top 10, but the fundamentals underpinning them are really important. And when they exhibit the right qualities, you know, we're happy to get behind them.
Okay. And you've not offered Monero, and you've also not offered Dash. I'm assuming you will have taken a look at them. Is there any reason, specifically Monero, any specific reason as a privacy coin you've not looked at it?
Sure. So for us, we're looking, I think, primarily, well, one, I think we've gotten pretty good at bringing these products to market and being able to wrap a digital currency inside of a security and make it available in that, you know, much more traditional financial instrument form. That being said, there are two, I think, major gating items to us putting a given token into one of the Grayscale products. I think number one is looking at the underlying market for the coin. So if the market isn't going to be accessible or liquid, or we won't be able to get to a place where we have in our possession a reference rate that is robust and highly representative, well, then that makes it really difficult for us to put a product around it.
And what is a reference rate, for those who don't know?
Well, so a reference rate meaning an index or some kind of pricing rate so that every day we can fairly value the assets and provide investors with a transparent pricing and valuation. That's an issue when there isn't a robust enough marketplace. I think number two has to do with custody. And so if there isn't a custodial solution, because we use third-party custodians for all of our products, that meets our criteria and lets us sleep soundly at night, well, then that also is a major gating item to launching a product around it, because our investors' assets are of utmost importance to us. And then I think the third thing is that we, as a regulated business, are also transacting primarily through Genesis, our sister firm, which is a regulated SEC and FINRA regulated broker-dealer. And so if they're not able to trade in a given token, that also presents a problem for us to, you know, structure something around a given token. But even sometimes when we can get past all the aforementioned challenges, if investors aren't demanding a certain product from us, you know, that kind of pushes it kind of further down the list of priorities for us.
Okay, that's interesting, because I wouldn't have imagined, though, that investors would be demanding Zencash. But then I haven't taken a look at Zencash probably for about a year. I had a look today after, obviously, I've seen your announcement. And actually, it seems, if in some ways, it seems like a very well-organized protocol.
It is. It is. And again, it's not just, we're not always just listening to what investors want. We have our eyes and our ears open for investor demand and investor interest, but we are also keen to discover protocols that we're very excited about. And so it's important to remember the history of Grayscale and our product launches. You know, from the end of 2013 until April of 2017, we solely had a Bitcoin product. We were a one-trick pony. And I think it's important because for us, we knew that whatever product number two was or product number three was, when investors did so well with us around product number one, we had to be very, very selective about what two and three were going to be in that lineup, because we thought a lot of our first go-around investors would come to us when we launched product two and three. And so product two was Ethereum Classic, which a lot of the digital currency community had left for dead. Mm-hmm. After the DAO hack, after Ethereum Classic emerged, we really started digging in and looking at some of the underlying principles in Ethereum Classic. And it actually reminded us a lot of the principles that underpinned Bitcoin, and dissimilar from Bitcoin, just had very, you know, different use cases. And so we're often ones to launch products around protocols that we have interest in and we can wrap our minds around, not always what investors want.
It's quite interesting then, and you're probably very happy with the Coinbase announcement for Ethereum Classic.
Yeah.
It validates a lot of what you... Your conviction.
It does. I mean, you know, at Coinbase, it's not a heavy lift for them. You know, this was something that they already were somewhat dealing with in the background after the DAO hack. So, took them some time to get it figured out, but definitely a positive development for the Ethereum Classic community.
And then, outside of the currencies that you've created your products for, the only protocol really is Ethereum and Ethereum Classic. You haven't yet moved into EOS, Cardano, Tron. You haven't looked at any of the other protocols. Is there any particular reason?
I think a lot of that, again, comes down to custodial solutions. You know, not without going into protocol by protocol. You know, when there isn't sufficient investor demand and there isn't sound custodial options available, it really makes it a non-starter for us. But we're always looking to create new products. You know, Zencash will be Grayscale's ninth product, but I would say on our list of products, there's probably 20, 30 products that we'd like to bring to market over time.
Right, okay. And do you see any impact on the market when you do release a product? Are you leveraging influence now? Like, the next Coinbase announcement is kind of a big deal. Are you starting to see that the next Grayscale trust is a influence in the market?
I believe that we do. I mean, it depends on what token it may be and where it is in its life cycle. But, you know, I was told last week, I was at the Yahoo event in San Francisco, when I had announced that Zencash would be our ninth product, saw about a 20% rise in the price of Zencash that same day. So, you know, perhaps on some of the more thinly traded protocols like that, yeah, it can have a material effect on price.
Okay. You mentioned custody. I'm going to come back to that, because I think having, you know, 1.5 to 3 billion digital assets.
It's a big burden.
Yeah, it must be scary, but I'm going to come back to that. So your products are investment trusts. Can you explain what they are and how they work for people who don't understand?
Sure. So the seven single currency products we have are solely and passively invested in the coin for which they're named. So our Bitcoin investment trust, our Ethereum Classic investment trust, so on and so forth. And so if you're an accredited investor, you can come to Grayscale and purchase shares of any one of those trusts on any day at a transparently struck 4 p.m. net asset value price. So much the same way you might buy a mutual fund. And so if you're an investor looking to allocate to the space, you don't want to figure out where to buy, how to hold, how to safekeep digital currencies, you can use the Grayscale products to, you know, express a view on digital currency. And so each of these products is solely and passively invested in the coin. So there's no cash, no leverage, no trading, nothing at all. It's basically just the same exposure as you'd have in digital currency directly, but through owning it in a security. The eighth product, the Digital Large Cap Fund, is actually a Cayman LLC, and that structure is optimized because the product will change. It rebalances every quarter. And so the Digital Large Cap Fund will always seek to have as its holdings the tokens which constitute the upper 70% of the digital currency market. So at the moment, that is Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Litecoin, and Ripple. But we will see at June 30th, our next rebalancing, what that is.
So you may have to consider EOS.
We may have to consider a lot of assets. We have to see what qualifies and disqualifies. There are definitely rules. It's a rules-based methodology. But once again, if there are certain custodial or other operational issues that prevent us from adding a coin or that we're not comfortable with, you know, then that's obviously going to be superseding that. And so each of these products is available on a daily basis, and investors who are buying them have to hold on to them for 1 year. So we are not a great place for folks who are interested in buying and selling very rapidly. This is a place for people who are looking to allocate capital to the space and have at least a 1 year outlook for it. On the other side of the year, investors get liquidity in the shares that they bought from us by selling them out onto the stock market. So two of our products are already out on the stock market. That's our Bitcoin Investment Trust. It trades under the symbol GBTC. And our Ethereum Classic vehicle just started trading last month under the symbol ETCG. And when each of the other six products get to their first birthdays, we will also seek to establish a public quotation for them so that investors can start rolling out their shares into the public market after they've each hit their 1 year hold period.
Did I see that Merrill Lynch have banned their advisors from selling your products?
So I believe, I don't want to speak to exactly what their policy is at the moment, but I believe that on a solicited basis, they did write, I've seen articles that they are banning that.
And do you think this is a fear of the unknown? And I know you guys are good at educating the market.
More likely than not, a fear of the unknown. We spend a lot of time with banks trying to educate them, financial advisors, hedge funds, etc. But a lot of people are still not over that initial 101, 201 learning curve that they need to get comfortable with investing in digital assets.
Right. So where do you think the gap is? Where's the fear coming from? Is it just volatility?
I mean, a lot of it's volatility, but the volatility is dampened quite a bit. I think a lot of people, I mean, we are fortunate. We get to talk to some of the smartest investors in the world. And those that have actually dug in, done their homework on digital currency, all always come out of the other side of that analysis, amazed, excited, wanting to put capital to work. I tend to find those who don't do their homework and don't dig in are the ones who are the naysayers.
Okay. So the investment trusts are essentially a 1 year lockup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the types of investors you have in are institutional. And it feels like essentially the fee they pay is for you to pretty much handle custody for them.
Correct. Yeah. So it's high net worth individuals, it's family offices, it's hedge funds, all those types of investors.
And probably the kind of people who just don't understand the space, a little bit scared of custody, a little bit scared of handling themselves. So they're happy to pay the fee for you to take that.
Correct. Or it's also institutions who by and large can't self-custody their own assets.
Right. Okay.
So if they have a prime brokerage relationship for their stocks, their bonds, et cetera, they can't buy digital currency and then clear it through Goldman Sachs or through, you know, Merrill Lynch or somebody mm-hmm. like that. And so the ability for them to gain exposure through a security fits squarely within their mandate. The same way they might use the gold ETF, GLD, to express a view on gold, they can use any of the Grayscale products to express a view on any one of those digital currencies.
How do your products differ from an ETF?
So they are not ETFs in that they are not registered and they do not sit on a national exchange. And there's also no redemption mechanism like there is in ETFs. But in many other respects, they offer investors the ability to gain exposure to an asset that otherwise has frictions through the purchase of a security. So in many ways, they feel like it, but they are not ETFs.
And you guys were looking at an ETF at one point, right?
Yeah, we spent the better part of 2017 registering our Bitcoin vehicle, GBTC, as an ETF on the New York Stock Exchange. We made tremendous progress with our regulators, but ultimately pulled out of that process late in 2017, just realizing that our regulators weren't yet ready for it.
So do you think the ETFs are coming?
We do. I mean, I think from our perspective, it's a when, not an if, but it's very early in the life cycle of educating regulators around this. But I think given that GBTC, our Bitcoin vehicle, is, you know, one of the top three most heavily traded securities on the OTC market in the U.S. every day, is pretty strong evidence that investors want securitized exposure to digital assets like Bitcoin.
And are these institutional investors coming in because they've got a fear of missing out and they feel like they need to have this within their portfolio, that they feel like they'll miss the early gold run? Or is this just now a sensible component of a balanced portfolio of products?
All of the above. You have some investors carving out a piece of gold, a gold allocation, and putting it into digital assets. looking at the riskiest end of the spectrum of where they invest, and that's why they're putting money to work in digital currencies, because they are risky, they are volatile. You have some investors who feel that digital currencies are influencing or impacting other areas where they invest, payments and other technologies. And you also have a lot of people who recognize that this is an asset that's arrived. It's not going away, and they have to put some money to work in order to force themselves to pay attention to it.
Right. And of your seven products, I've noticed, is it four currently are in negative, three are in positive? Obviously, your Bitcoin trust is doing very well from launch. So obviously, it's been a rocky time for the last 6 months. And I know from friends who've got in the space late who I was telling last year, who finally took the dip in December, January, and now kind of in a loss position. And I'm telling them to, you know, just be patient. Are you having similar conversations now that people feel like, oh, you know, there's some regret or fear?
I think that people are viewing the downtrend in prices general as opportunities to get in lower, particularly in the fixed supply assets, where they feel like, the depression in prices presents more opportunity than it does doubt or uncertainty, which is interesting because I think throughout the end of 2017 and the beginning of this year, one of the reasons we launched our digital large cap fund, our diversified fund, is because we were encountering people who were saying, I think I missed Bitcoin, or I think I missed Ethereum, or I'm not sure how to pick the winners or, you know, avoid the losers or whatever it may have been. And so, you know, that's why Grayscale launched its first diversified offering. You've also seen a lot of other asset managers popping up with index-like products so that people can make a singular investment but get broad-based exposure.
Yes, because Coinbase have just launched theirs, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, what's the difference between theirs and yours?
Well, so I think everybody has different criteria that
you have a lower entry criteria on amount to invest, right?
Yeah, and also I think with the actual constituent tokens, whether or not it rebalances, what reference rates are used, et cetera. There's a lot of different nuances between the various products out there.
And do you have any kind of view on the actual market for dApps and things being built? Because one of the main criticisms that keeps coming back is, where are the products? Where are people actually building things that people are using?
Sure. So, not at the Grayscale level, but at Digital Currency Group, we've now again invested in 130 different digital currency related businesses in over 30 countries around the world. And so we hope we're investing in the businesses that are building the picks and the shovels, so to speak, right? The exchanges, the wallets, the infrastructure, the order management systems, the indices, the payment rails, the identity management solutions, et cetera. Those are definitely alive and doing quite well. I think some other kind of decentralized applications, other things kind of built on top of Ethereum and some other protocols like that are still very early in their life cycle.
Yeah, I personally have a concern or a worry that there isn't actually a need for this many decentralized applications that people think. I think possibly a lot of opportunities, the building of centralized products, which traditional world of finance and companies understand, on top of this decentralized, like liquidity pool that people can access.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you're totally right, and I think we share your same view. You know, we don't need a decentralized Uber. We don't need a decentralized Airbnb. You know, these are platforms that by and large work really, really well and have fantastic global communities that are contributing and using them. But I think there are certain areas where there is definitely a need for decentralization, and some of those products and services will grow and thrive.
There's a lot of talk about the tokenization of assets. Do you believe in that as an opportunity?
We do, but it's not going to exist or thrive outside of a more firm regulatory landscape for it. I was saying earlier at the conference today, and I've said quite a bit before, you know, we look at other industries, manufacturing, healthcare, and even financial services. You know, these are all industries that have regulatory frameworks around them, and thus the products, the businesses, the services, the consumer protections, et cetera, that all come inside those industries all are available because there's a regulatory framework around them. And so we think the same is going to be true, or hope to be true, of digital assets, including, you know, security tokens and various applications like that.
My fear with security tokens, or my concern, is raising capital in volatile cryptocurrencies whilst having to operate a business in dollar, pound, whichever jurisdiction you're in. Do you see, therefore, an opportunity for stable coins to exist within? It seems to me almost like for securities to work, they will need a stable coin.
Yeah, I mean, the entire ecosystem of stable coins is still very nascent. I mean, slightly more nascent than Bitcoin and other protocols, obviously. But it's too early in the life cycle of some of these projects like Basecoin to fully assess whether or not they'll come to fruition or what impact they'll have.
I can't see them being in trust that you would create for a stable coin.
Probably not.
Okay, so...
But I never say never.
Never say never. Okay, so I want to talk to you about custody. I mean, I get nervous managing a handful of Bitcoin or a few Litecoin, and you're...
As you should.
As I am, and everyone should be. But you're handling billions here.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me about how you handle custody and, you know, what keeps you up at night and...
Sure. So, I mean, for us, we partner with what we always believe to be the leading digital asset custodial solutions available to us. I think as the world's largest asset manager, we have a fiduciary responsibility to not only constantly be vetting who is new in coming up in that world and what services they're offering, but also staying in very close dialogue with our existing custodial solutions, all of which are third parties, looking at what they're doing to ward off threats and different kinds of attacks, because there's always a target on their back. And so on the Bitcoin side of things, we work with a firm called Xapo, X-A-P-O.
Are they the guys with the big vault underground?
They have several big vaults underground, one of which I've, you know, visited several times. You know, we have to constantly do our due diligence on these firms and involves security, experts that we consult with, our lawyers, our auditors, our accountants. We also have to, you know, ensure that their disaster recovery systems are up to snuff. Really, there is a really heavy, heavy list of items that we go through with every single provider we would work with. And oftentimes, even though someone's technology may be great, operationally it may not work for our business, or they may not have the right types of registrations or legal frameworks under which they're operating. And so for us, we're constantly flying around the world looking at who's new in the custodial space and trying to stay ahead of the curve.
So you're using multiple custodial solutions to de-risk
yourselves? Yeah, so for our Bitcoin vehicle, all of the Bitcoin is held with Xapo. Okay. For our other vehicles, we have created a solution on top of Ledger's technology that layers on cryptographic cryptographic security and geographical dispersion. And so we had to layer on this ad hoc solution on top of Ledger's technology, not because Ledger isn't in of itself secure, but because we wanted to create a similar framework to Xapo, who again is employing those three different pillars. So, you know, for us, we're going to see who else is new and coming up in the world. But for now, these are the solutions that we feel are most sound.
So is that a custody solution you're managing yourself?
It's a custody solution of which we are one of many, many, many pieces that need to come together in order to access any digital currency.
Sounds really scary.
It's not scary. I mean, it's a robust solution such that, you know, no one or group of individuals has unilateral access to digital currency. And so quite easy to get digital currency in, exceedingly difficult to get digital currency out of any of these platforms.
Right. So I want to talk a bit about the market. Obviously, it was an amazing year last year, but obviously the downtrend has been quite emotional for a lot of people. It feels like a lot of people have been kind of upset and left the market, but you still obviously believe in it. So what do you believe is happening with the market? How do you see the rest of the year playing out?
Some really good things on the horizon. I think one, getting regulatory clarity from places like the SEC that Ethereum is not a security that we saw last week is great.
Is that an actual confirmation? Because I've read different things.
It's a pretty strong statement, and those kinds of statements are vetted before they're provided. So, I think for now the community is taking stock in it. I think from our perspective, we're seeing a major shift in who's involved in the space. seeing a movement out of kind of softer, weaker retail hands and seeing those assets move into the hands of institutions who are true believers. They know they can be, they have to be patient and will be patient to see the asset class kind of come to fruition. And so I think when you couple that with some other great kind of product announcements and seeing some more custodial solutions coming online this year, some more major institutions coming online this year, be it non-deliverable forwards at Goldman Sachs or the Fidelity custody solution or other assets like that come, other, you know, important announcements like that coming online, you'll, I think, see a firming up of prices and certainly see more adoption.
And it's a really interesting shift to see products coming from Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, the likes of who previously have been very critical of cryptocurrency and putting out statements which people would call FUD. Why do you see this now? What's changed?
So I think the taboo nature of the asset class has been shrugged off. When I was in the space starting in 2014, you know, there were no banks, no insurance companies, no credit card companies. Nobody had done anything in the space. And then Goldman Sachs invested with Digital Currency Group into Circle. And as soon as Goldman Sachs did that, it provided enough air cover for pretty much every other bank and other major financial institution to get involved in the space. And so once again, you know, maybe it is Goldman taking the lead by offering non-deliverable forwards, and maybe that forces other banks to get into the space in a derivative sense, which is then maybe the precursor to trading spot digital assets like Bitcoin. But I think it's meaningfully graduated as a whole from that early days of, you know, human trafficking and the dark web to really a platform for innovation that's creating kind of this next layer of money.
And obviously you've worked in the banking, traditional banking sector. How do you see cryptocurrencies changing banking or impacting banking?
Oof, that's a loaded question.
Yeah, I know.
It's too hard to say at the moment. I will say one, though, that, you know, what I'm seeing from global banks is often that the blockchain or distributed ledger technology working groups inside each of these institutions is oftentimes, unfortunately, getting very frustrated. They're trying to make progress. They're trying to create proofs of concept within their respective organizations. But then ultimately, there's so much red tape and so many layers of approval that not enough progress is being made. And many of these folks are leaving places like, you know, major financial institutions and moving either to start their own digital currency related businesses or joining firms like DCG. And so when that happens, it's great to see that shift of human capital and talent, but then I also then lose my, you know, friends behind enemy lines, so to speak.
Right. Okay. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Cause we have seen a number of, you know, especially with Coinbase, a number of key recruitments. And also there was recently Andreas put out a very interesting point that there's very little difference between Coinbase and a bank.
That's a decent perspective. And actually, Grayscale has had a really high profile hire recently. So our new VP of finance, her name is Samantha McDonald. She is actually the outgoing CFO from the Spider Gold ETF. So the Spider Gold ETF is the largest gold ETF globally. And so to see her go from taking the finance role at the largest gold, you know, ETF to coming over to Grayscale, who owns the largest Bitcoin or what I'll call digital gold investment product, is really a representation of that shift from this old, stodgy, antiquated gold into what many of us believe is gold 2.0.
Okay. So just considering what's happening in the future, can you tell me now what's coming up for Grayscale? What's coming up for you? What you're excited about? And yeah.
Sure. So we just recently announced that we were talking about earlier that we're going to launch our Zencash vehicle in the third quarter of this year. So super excited about that. I think it's our hope to bring out at least one or two more products in the back half of this year. But in the meantime, we're very focused on building out our team, building our asset base, and really continuing to try and be thought leaders in the industry.
And who do you want to hear from? How can they get hold of you?
So we want to hear from anybody and everybody. We want to hear from investors looking to get smarter about the space. We are an asset manager, so we're always looking to raise assets. We're not going to be shy about that. So the best way to get in touch with us is going to our website, www.grayscale.co. You can get in touch with us there, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, and always, first and foremost, want to be an educational resource, but obviously happy to field any investment inquiries as well.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you for doing this. It was great to catch up, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Okay. What did you make of that? Did you enjoy that? Did you learn a bit more about institutional investment? I hope you did. It was good for me. It was good to meet with Michael and understand a bit more about how they decide on their products, how they shape them, and what the institutional mindset is. It's pretty interesting how much money they've raised this year. I think he said it was $225 million from institutional investors. So even in a bearish market, they're still raising funds. So that's pretty cool. So please do continue to support the show. If you don't mind leaving a review on iTunes, that means a lot. If you want to follow me on social media, I'm at What Bitcoin Did. I've told you the website, but that's www.whatbitcoindid.com. And you can email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Okay, listen, I hope you all have a cracking week, and I look forward to speaking to you next week.